Senate Banking, Housing, Urban Affairs will come to order. Undersecretary Liang, welcome. Glad you're here. Thank you. Our witnesses in person, members have the option to appear either in person or virtually. So thank you. Let me start talking about the Federal Reserve for a moment. This afternoon at 2:15, we will be meeting in SVC 200, the visitor center at the bottom of the steps, to mark up 5 Federal Reserve nominees and 1 for FHFA. We need a full Federal Reserve Board of Governors to bring down prices and put workers first. It will be the first time in a decade we've seen a full complement of governors once we confirm in committee and on the floor these 5 nominees. Ranking Member Toomey and I agreed on the dates 3 weeks ago. We agreed on the dates for the hearing and markup. Americans are depending on us to get these people on the job as soon as possible. If my colleagues are as concerned about inflation as they claim to be in this committee and beyond, they will not slow down this process, which will hurt workers, their families, and our recovery. If you watched the Super Bowl on Sunday, you saw ad after ad for a product that most Americans have heard of, but almost nobody knows what it really is. Even many of the people who've bought it often don't really understand it. Big crypto companies are looking to make big profits, are desperate to reach as many Americans as they can. They brought in celebrities and gimmicks to make crypto sound exciting and daring and profitable. But the ads left a few things out. They didn't mention the fraud, the scams, and the outright theft. The ads didn't point out that you can lose big in crypto's huge price swings. They didn't tell you about the high fees pocketed by the crypto companies. They sure didn't explain that crypto markets lack basic investor protections and oversight. Just a few weeks ago, hackers stole $300 million of people's investments from a crypto platform. The fact that these companies felt the need to advertise at all is a bit of a giveaway about one of their major claims. If this were actually meant to be used as a currency, why would you need to buy ads? I don't think I've ever seen in 40 years of Super Bowl watching the Federal Reserve buy a multi-million dollar commercial for U.S. dollars. That's because crypto isn't money. It's designed for speculation. Watching those ads reminded a lot of us of some asset bubbles we've seen before. 2000 Super Bowl featured 21 ads from 14 different dot-com startups. The internet may have been the next frontier, but these companies surely weren't. Many of them were defunct within a year or two. Only 4 from those 14 are still around. We're here today because, once again, real people's real money is at risk. We need to look beyond the unproven promises, protect Americans and our entire financial system. In a hearing last July, this committee examined the risk of cryptocurrencies to our. In December, we looked closely at the mechanics behind stablecoins and stablecoin companies. Today, we're joined by Treasury Undersecretary Liang to look at the risks stablecoins pose and how regulators in Congress can protect consumers. Last fall, the Treasury Department led a team of our financial regulators to conduct a report on stablecoins. This report makes it clear that without regulation, stablecoins can endanger our economy, our payment system, our hard-earned money. And while stablecoins suggest they're like money, good luck trying to use one at the store. Their main purpose today is to make it easier to trade, to speculate, and in some cases, unfortunately, especially, even hide assets in crypto and digital markets. In just a few years, stablecoins have mushroomed into a $175 billion with a B, dollar market. They're asking us to believe that what they build is as good as real money and that it works the way these startups say it does. Americans in this committee should look carefully at those promises. The companies claim that a stablecoin is backed by real dollars invested in a reserve account. That's what makes it stable. But our financial regulators have tested that claim by a giant stablecoin issuer. That issuer ended up paying nearly $60 million in fines because it lied about its reserves. It turns out that for over 2 years, a stablecoin was really backed 28% of the time. Stablecoins say that you can, quote, redeem a stablecoin whenever you want, exchanging it back into dollars from the stablecoin's reserve. But the fine print in the agreements, some of the biggest companies says that ordinary consumers cannot actually redeem their stablecoins for dollars from the company that issues them. Only institutions like hedge funds can. And even then, many stablecoin issuers can delay redemptions or refuse them entirely. So if you saw a Super Bowl ad, you'd figure out you'd give this a try, and you change your mind and want to exchange your stablecoin for dollars, you might be out of luck. The website could be down. Your money could be trapped. Stablecoin issuers also promise their product will serve people who have been left behind in the financial system. Their interest in helping the unbanked, they always start with that. But as we've established, crypto doesn't actually function as real currency in any traditional sense that Americans for decades have understood. Allowing more people to trap their money in risky, speculative investments isn't the kind of financial inclusion that people seek. It's not going to do anything to help Americans working hourly jobs who don't put their paychecks into banks because of abusive fees. Finally, stablecoins companies say that if you hand them your money will be safe. They tell us that they structure their reserves so that people's money is protected, that their businesses will weather any kind of crisis. Now, maybe the stablecoin coins are right, companies are right. Maybe we should just close our eyes and trust that a product called Magic Internet Money, run by an outfit called Abracadabra, That's a safe place for your money. I'm not sure working Americans want to take that risk. Remember in 2007 and 8 when the banks said home prices would go up and mortgages would never be underwater? You remember those days? Then as now, it's workers and their families whose homes and hard-earned savings are being used as gambling chips. They're the ones always, 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 often because of the actions of this House and Senate in this conservative, too often committee, they're the ones who pay the price. I understand the appeal of crypto. Americans have been burned over and over again by Wall Street. The 2008 crisis, abusive fees, a stock market that's just detached from reality. Of course people don't trust big banks. They figure, how could putting my money in one of these new products be any worse than the scams I've seen in the banking system? Maybe they're thinking I'll finally get in on the kinds of deals that have been making investment bankers wealthy for a generation. Some of those Super Bowl ads are pretty compelling television. They make vague allusions to innovation in the future, and who could be against innovation? But we've ignored warnings like the report we're talking about too many times before. Before the crisis, Congress and regulators ignored warnings about the risky bets and the increasing leverage and over-the-counter derivatives on Wall Street. Then the banks got a bailout. Again, working people paid the price. That's why I want Congress and regulators to work together to tackle these issues now before it's too late. I urge my colleagues to listen carefully to Undersecretary Liang's testimony and to the warnings in the PWG, the President's Working Group report. We need a strong, proactive approach from regulators in Congress to limit stablecoin risk for working Americans. As our economy continues to recover from COVID-19, as workers finally are starting to see higher wages and more bargaining power in the workplace, the last thing we need is for a risky new financial product to cause disaster. This isn't the first hearing that the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee has had on stablecoins. It won't be the last. Ranking Member Toomey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Lang, welcome. Thank you for coming to the committee. Thanks for taking the time to chat recently. I enjoyed our conversation. It was about 2 months ago that this committee held its first hearing on stablecoins, and I was encouraged to hear from our witnesses about the essential role that stablecoins play in the larger cryptocurrency trading ecosystem. But it's also important to note the tremendous potential stablecoins have to be adopted as a common medium of exchange in the broader ordinary goods and services economy. Unlike cryptocurrencies that fluctuate in value, stablecoins are designed to maintain a one-to-one value relative to some reference asset, typically a fiat currency such as the US dollar. Put simply, one stablecoin is meant always to be worth $1. Because of this price stability, stablecoins have the potential to serve all the traditional functions of money by acting as a medium of exchange, unit of account, as well as a store of value. Stablecoins can also improve upon traditional forms of money by increasing payment speed, especially cross-border transfers, reducing transaction costs, and helping to combat illicit finance through the creation of an immutable and transparent transaction record. Stablecoins can also be programmed to execute payments automatically upon the occurrence of some pre-designated verifiable event. This capability in particular has the potential to transform finance and, in time, much of our economy. Any regulatory regime for stablecoins will inevitably focus on consumer protections and systemic stability. But at least as important will be preserving the tremendous, unimaginable benefits that will flow from future innovations. as stablecoin usage has grown significantly, regulators have increasingly taken an interest. In last November's report from the President's Working Group on Financial Markets, spearheaded by Ms. Lange, appropriately recommended that Congress pass legislation to establish a federal regulatory framework for stablecoins. The PWG report recommends Congress address three perceived prudential concerns. First, stablecoin runs. Second, payment system risks. And third, systemic risk and concentration of economic power. Now, the principal recommendation is that stablecoin issuance be limited to insured depository institutions. Now, I commend the contribution of the public discussion that the PWG has contributed, but I strongly disagree with that particular recommendation. I think we can protect against concerns such as run risk through a less restrictive and more appropriately tailored approach. So to accomplish those objectives, I released a set of guiding principles for stablecoin legislation. These principles recognize that stablecoin issuers have significantly different business models than banks, and they present different risks. For example, stablecoin issuers typically neither make loans nor deposits, nor take deposits. They may choose not to transform maturity or to intermediate credit risk. And as such, stablecoin issuers using cash or cash equivalents to back its coin is likely safer than most existing financial institutions. Because of these differences, it would be inappropriate to subject stablecoin issuers to the full range of bank regulations meant to address risks posed by the fractional reserve deposit and lending banking system. So I was encouraged that Ms. Lange has recognized these differences and sensibly agreed that there should be regulatory flexibility for stablecoin issuers not engaged in traditional banking. But that does raise the natural question, why require all stablecoin issuers to become insured depository institutions then? My legislation will take a different approach. It will provide regulatory treatment that is flexible and adaptable to future technological innovation. It'll also promote competition in the stablecoin market by allowing at least three types of regulated entities to issue stablecoins. First, my legislation would preserve the regime to which the majority of stablecoin issuers are currently subject as state-registered money service businesses and money transmitters. To disrupt this regime would both introduce unnecessary burdens to an emerging technology and unwisely diminish the success of states with experience and expertise in this area. Rather than discard this regime, we should build on it to ensure the public has the right disclosures about stablecoin reserves to make an appropriately informed decision about whether to use any particular stablecoin. Second, my legislation will clarify that insured depository institutions are actually, in fact, permitted to issue stablecoins. The former head of the OCC, Brian Brooks, pioneered work to give banks clarity on digital asset activities, but the current OCC has created confusion regarding permissible activities. Finally, my approach will establish a new stablecoin charter with regulatory requirements designed specifically for stablecoin issuers. The requirements will address the risks identified by the PWG report, but will not force stablecoin issuers into a one-size-fits-all system created for traditional banks. Ms. Lange's recent testimony indicates to me that I think she agrees with the idea of a tailored approach for such issuers. Rather than just rely on the flexibility of the existing framework for depository institutions, which leaves full discretion of bank regulators, however, I think it's the responsibility of Congress to design this approach. So these three paths would allow each stablecoin issuer to choose the regulatory framework most appropriate for its own business model. Now, under this legislation, each stablecoin issuer would be required to meet certain minimum requirements regardless of the charter or license. For example, all would be required to disclose the assets that back the stablecoin. All would be required to adopt and clearly disclose redemption policies. And they'd have to undergo third-party audits. These requirements would ensure that consumers have sufficient information to choose which stablecoin they use. Ms. Lange's thoughtful comments on stablecoin regulation lead me to believe that there are many issues on which we can find common ground. So I look forward to developing legislation with my Senate colleagues and working with the administration to establish a regulatory framework for stablecoins that addresses potential risks while also encouraging innovation and competition. Thank you.
Thank you, Ranking Member Toomey. Today's witness, we'll hear from Nellie Liang, the Undersecretary of the Treasury for Domestic Finance. Madam Undersecretary, please proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Chairman Brown, Ranking Member Toomey, and other members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning on stablecoin report by the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. The PWG is chaired by the Secretary of the Treasury and composed of the Federal Reserve Board, the SEC, and the CFTC. It was formed by a presidential executive order in response to the 1987 stock market crash and regularly produces reports on financial market issues for the president, which may include recommended legislative changes. For the stablecoin report, the PWG was joined by the FDIC and the OCC. Stablecoins are part of an emerging set of digital assets, activities, and services that could have profound implications for the U.S. financial system and economy. The distinguishing feature of stablecoins as compared to other digital assets is that they are designed to maintain a stable value relative to a reference asset, often the U.S. dollar. Stablecoins have grown rapidly from a market capitalization of roughly $5 billion at the start of 2020 to approximately $175 billion today. The PWG report focused on stablecoins because the offer of a stable value means they have the potential to be used widely as a means of payment by households, businesses, and financial firms. This potential use could create significant benefits for stablecoin users and payment transactions, but it could also pose risks. The PWG report focused on three prudential risks associated with the use of stablecoins for payments. First, run risk, a scenario in which loss of confidence in a stablecoin triggers a wave of redemptions, which could have spillover effects for the broader financial system. Second, payment risk, including operational issues that could interfere with the ability of users to store stablecoins or use them to make payments. And third, concerns related to concentration of economic power. For example, if a stablecoin provider scaled up quickly and gained market power as a provider of payment services. The PWG report found significant gaps in authorities that would address these prudential risks. Some of the largest stablecoin issuers operate with limited regulatory oversight, raising significant questions about whether their stablecoins are adequately backed. Even where a stablecoin issuer is subject to oversight, supervisors may not have sufficient visibility into the broader operations that support the use of stablecoins, which may be distributed across multiple entities. Neither state money transmitter nor securities law requirements were designed to address the financial stability payment system risks for a payment instrument based on new distributed ledger technology. To fill this regulatory gap, the PWG report recommended legislation to ensure that stablecoins are subject to a consistent and comprehensive framework that is proportionate to the risks posed. Such legislation would complement existing authorities with respect to market integrity, investor and consumer protection, and illicit finance. Specifically, the report recommended limiting issuance of stablecoins to insured depository institutions, giving supervisors of stablecoin issuers visibility into the broader stablecoin arrangements, and authority to set risk management standards for critical activities related to the use of stablecoins for payment, and certain measures to reduce concerns related to concentration of economic power. In developing the recommendation for stablecoin issuers to be insured depository institutions, the PWG report relied upon the flexibility that banking agencies would have to adjust for differences between stablecoin issuers and traditional commercial banks, and to adjust to new products and structures that may emerge over time. As noted at the beginning of my testimony, stablecoins are a subset of the large and quickly evolving digital assets market. The Treasury Department supports responsible innovation from digital assets, but is also committed to protecting against risks to users, the financial system, and the broader economy. The Biden administration continues to work across the agencies to develop a comprehensive strategy for all digital assets, with the goals of ensuring that cryptocurrency is not used for illicit finance, addressing risks related to financial stability and consumer and investor protection, and furthering financial inclusion and our continued leadership of the global financial system. We look forward to working with Congress on these critical issues as we make progress and appreciate the committee's leadership in this area. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Madam Undersecretary. Stable coins are, as we know, only a few years old. We know most Americans have never bought one. Commercials in Silicon Valley just tell us stable coins are an innovation. I want to be clear, though, Madam Undersecretary, about the stakes here. How important is it we act now to regulate stable coins before they can hurt our economy? How could stable coins hurt working families if Congress and regulators don't rein in the risks of these products?
Thank you for your question, Senator Brown. As I mentioned, the digital asset market is growing very rapidly. The fundamental change is this new innovation that can allow for new provision of financial services and could radically change the way financial services are provided. This provides a lot of benefits, could bring efficiencies, especially to the payment system, and when we're speaking of cryptocurrencies. It also raises some of the concerns, of course, that you raised earlier on illicit finance, tax evasion, fraud. So it's important to address those issues. My view is, given these risks and the growth of the market, it's important for regulators and policymakers to take some actions to protect users and ensure the resilience of the financial system. Stablecoins are a subset of this digital asset space. The prospect of stable value gives them the potential to be used for payment transactions, a store of value, a medium of exchange. That raises a different set of risks. They have the ability to provide payments on 24/7, to reduce the costs of payments in a substantive way. I think it has the potential to be part of the future payment system. So I think it is important to assess the stability of stable coins. Are they stable? Can they provide the services that they offer themselves to? The Secretary of the Treasury convened the PWG to evaluate whether they can be stable and to address whether this new product has an adequate regulatory framework. And the PWG report recommended that there should be additional authorities provided to regulators for this product.
Thank you. The stablecoin companies assure us they're transparent. They tell us they follow the law. They like to say they're built on trust. But of course they say that. They want to suggest if you buy stablecoins with dollars, your dollars will be safe. And you'll be able to exchange stablecoins back for dollars without a problem. Madam Undersecretary, is there any risk that people with stablecoin won't always be able to exchange stablecoin for dollars? If so, do these companies make that clear to consumers?
There is risk that stablecoins cannot deliver dollar. They say they're stablecoins. The assets backing the stablecoins may not be able to deliver a dollar under stress periods. And in fact, if you look at stablecoins, they do fluctuate. In addition, there's issues around redemption. As well as there could be fees that may not be disclosed. So I do think there are features of stablecoins that create run risk, which is the first risk that the PWG report
identified. Are those companies informing potential purchasers of stablecoin that there is that risk?
They are not required to by any regulators because they are not regulated.
Understand that, but are they doing that? Your experience?
So there are probably 50 or 60 different stable coins at this point in time. I imagine the practices vary quite a bit.
Okay. I think it's worth your knowing that the answer to that are most of them, if there are 50 or 60, do they Do they disclose the risk at all? I'm not asking right now. I am asking right now, but I think it's something important to know. Last question. For a long time in this country, we've prevented commercial companies from partnering with financial companies. In some ways, we've built a wall between the two. There have been reports that companies like Walmart might think about issuing a stable coin. Is anything right now stopping Amazon or Walmart or another big company from starting their own stable coin? And if so, what are the risks if they do that?
So currently, I don't believe, because stablecoin issuers are licensed by state money transmitter requirements, there is nothing that stops a commercial company from wanting to issue a stablecoin. The PWG proposal for an IDI for the issuer would preclude a commercial company from being an issuer. The PWG recommendations also are to consider whether, for Congress to consider whether the custodial wallet providers or other service providers related to the stablecoin arrangement could be commercial or should be limited to financial. But this is an issue that Congress, the separation of banking and commerce has been an issue that Congress has grappled with over many times in different periods, and this is another area where it's an area for them to consider carefully.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. Senator Toomey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Lang, so as I said, I appreciate the work that the PWG has done. I disagree with some of the conclusions, but it was a constructive addition to this ongoing public discussion. One of my criticisms is I don't think that the PWG report took sufficient account of the existing state-based regulatory a framework. And as you just pointed out, stablecoin issuers do operate as state-based money transmitters, also trust companies. And it occurs to me that a stablecoin issued by a trust company, if it's backed solely by cash and cash equivalents, could very well be safer than many existing financial institutions, including many banks. It seems that be sensible for a trust company that issued such a safe, fully backed stablecoin ought to be subject to a different regulatory regime than a traditional bank because its business model is so different. So my question for you, if Congress were to authorize a well-defined charter that was specific to stablecoins for, let's say, this type of institution, a trust company that issues a stablecoin fully backed, do you think that could be designed in a manner that's consistent with safety and soundness?
Thank you for the question. So I believe that the regulation for stablecoins should be flexible, should reflect the risks of the stablecoin activity. And stablecoin issuers that issue only stablecoins, do not extend credit, should not need to be subject to the sort of full set of banking regulations that relate to credit provision. So flexibility, I agree, is very important. The trust charters, and this may vary across states, are designed more for, have been developed for fiduciary responsibilities. They may not be, as currently structured, have the authority to reach in and see how the whole stablecoin arrangement that is needed to be a payment service is conducted. And so I think as we've talked to state supervisors and we've learned quite a lot from the experience they're building, they have less insight into the overall arrangement than at times they might like.
So. Yeah, and I guess that goes to the point that I was trying to make. I'm not suggesting that the existing state-based regime is perfect and we're finished and there's no work to be done here. But I am suggesting that it might serve as a part of a regulatory framework, an option that would be available with the overlay that would address some of the concerns that you just raised. Now, I appreciate you just once again reiterated a point that I think you've made before, that the full set of bank regulations really shouldn't need to apply if the issuer is not engaged in the full range of traditional banking. I think that's a really important distinction. And I think one of the things that we ought to consider is creating what some people call a narrow bank, a narrowly defined charter that would be well-suited for stablecoin issuers. Do you think a narrow bank could be consistent with the goals of the PWG report?
On a specific type of charter, I guess I could more comfortable with the issues it's trying to address. So I think staying flexible within an IDI framework, which I believe is flexible, to better match the activities and risks with the regulation. It does not need, the PWG report did not necessarily recommend deposit insurance, for example. So that would be consistent with a narrow bank. But it did require, it would like financial firms to be issuers, and for other parts of the stablecoin arrangement, it could be commercial, but that would be something for Congress to consider. So I think in terms of a narrow bank, that's that can be defined separately. I think sure. It's within the IDI charter with lots of flexibility to match the risks of the activities.
So where I think there's common ground here is a recognition that we both have that the nature of stablecoins and their issuers is very distinct from traditional banking, and therefore a different regulatory approach makes sense. Where we might have, I'm not sure, but we might have somewhat different views is how clearly Congress should prescribe what that looks like. My own preference is not, I acknowledge there is a lot of regulatory mm-hmm. discretion. I don't think that's the optimal way to proceed. I think it's better for Congress to provide some guide points. I want to make one last point, and I see I'm out of time. And that is, this is not a criticism of you. This is not an observation about Ms. Lange at all, but it's a general observation that Congress and regulators should remember our mission is not to make it impossible for a financial institution to fail. It is not to make it impossible for an investor to lose money. It is, in my view, to ensure that investors are well-informed about the risks that they choose to take, and to make sure that if there is a financial institution that fails, it doesn't have catastrophic systemic consequences. I hope we'll keep that in mind as we go down this road. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator Toomey. Senator Menendez from New Jersey is recognized from his office. I believe. Senator Warner is recognized from Virginia from his office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You got me a little bit quicker there.
I'm sorry.
Then let me just hold on
Thank
a
you,
second. I appreciate, again, you having this this hearing, Mr. Chairman. This is an issue I think we all need to learn a little more about. I've got a twofold question. One is, I want to reiterate, I think maybe you and the ranking member already raised this, you know, can we check on a real-time basis that there is sufficient backing on these stable coins? And let's assume for a moment there is, but I would like to get to reiteration of that from the undersecretary. But the bigger question I have is, assuming there is this backing and you've got, in a sense, potentially billions and billions of assets having that one-to-one backing, how is there a viable business model here for these stable coins unless they are charging exorbitant amount of fees and other add-on costs? I know the idea behind oftentimes stable coins is that there's less friction. There is you can transfer these resources from dollars here to currencies that may be unstable in second and third world nations. But still, if you've got a one-to-one backing and that kind of capital basically set aside, other than large transaction fees, how do these entities make any money? Undersecretary Lange?
Sure. Thank you for your question. So in terms of real-time backing, some of the...
You've got no volume, Mr. Chairman, here. I don't hear the...
Yeah, I seem to have lost the camera.
All right.
Some, I'm not sure if you can hear me. Some stable coins do provide audits of their assets and post them. There are no regulations, and there is no regulator to confirm those statements. In terms of the stable coin business model, it strikes me as there's probably several, and they probably vary. One is the backing for the stable coin of a dollar. Those assets could be invested in, say, longer-term securities, even safe securities, and there'd be some spread. But I think, as you point out, certainly there are fees that are charged to help to provide some revenue. But it is an area that is changing very rapidly. New products are being introduced every day. So I think the business model will evolve over time.
Madam Undersecretary, one thing I had reported to me from an expert in this field is if we look at these tokens on a bigger basis, not just in terms of stable coins, we've got about 7,000 publicly traded stocks in this country with the attendant regulations that are in place. You know, if you look at the crypto exchanges, there are about 17,000 tokens that are being traded on these crypto exchanges with, again, varying levels of backing, many of them not even claiming to be stable coins. An area that I know the ranking member and I have discussed, and we've got some legislation to make sure that people are not unfairly penalized, but in the world of DeFi and decentralized finance, there have been estimates, and I don't think there's an accurate number yet, but that there could be upwards literally of a million different coins or different tokens out in that field, all of them potentially moving to some of these cryptocurrency exchanges. Should we be concerned about this and the lack of transparency and the volume simply of these items that are being traded?
Yeah, so I think the what you're referring to is the rapid increase in the digital assets market and new products and new services that are being provided. And there are concerns about lack of transparency, the fraud, potential for manipulation, misleading advertising. Those are areas that are of great concern to regulators and believe that there needs to be important investor and consumer protections put in place for that. And that's an area that SEC and the CFTC are working actively in that space. Stable coins, just again to emphasize, are a subset, a small subset of that smaller space of digital assets, and they purport to have stable value. Their prices are not nearly as volatile as the prices of digital assets more broadly, but it's because of that promise of stable value they become the possible use for payments on a wide basis in the non-crypto world. And so in that sense, it raises a whole different set of risks, these prudential risks that the PWG report highlighted, the run risk, the payment system risk, and concentration of economic power.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate you holding the hearing, and I think there's great potential in digital assets, but boy, I think we've got a lot of education to go on. Thank you.
Senator Rounds from South Dakota is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think this is an excellent time to have this particular hearing as well. Undersecretary Lang, I'm just curious. In South Dakota, we have a number of different licensed crypto custodians. They have been licensed through the state of South Dakota and in some cases federally. Just to give you an example, we have Anchorage. This company received their charter from South Dakota Division of Banking in July of 2019. Anchorage Trust Company received its OCC charter in early 2021, becoming the first federally chartered digital asset bank in history. Now, although a bank, it does not offer deposit or lending services. BitGo. In September of 2018, BitGo was approved by the South Dakota Division of Banking to act as a qualified custodian for digital assets and created the BitGo Trust Company, Kingdom Trust. Kingdom Trust serves as an independent qualified custodian for the assets of clients of registered investment advisors, broker-dealers, and investment sponsors, as well as their individual retirement accounts, non-qualified plans, and qualified defined contribution 401k plans. Kingdom Trust Platform was the first to allow self-directed retirement accounts holding digital currency investments directly. Now, in each of these cases, these are custodians. They do not issue a stable coin, but they act as a custodian for digital assets. Stable coins, as you indicated, were just a small part of what could be used out there in terms of different cryptos or cryptocurrencies. I'm just curious. I think that stable coins definitely have a future, and I am concerned that if we do not put in appropriate but measured regulatory a system in place here, that we may very well fall behind other nations that do. If we want to continue to be the reserve currency of choice, I think we have to allow options for very efficient ways in which to make payments. I think stable coins can fit into that. If they are a viable payment mechanism, then it means that a regulatory environment that promotes that. And just the fact that all of these have occurred in just the last few years means that there's probably a lot more innovation to come in the future. And we most certainly don't want that innovation to be unnecessarily stymied by a one-size-fits-all regulatory environment here in the United States. Do you believe, after your review, do you believe that stablecoins have this capability of assisting and competing on an international basis if we put in a limited regulatory environment here in the United States?
Thank you, Senator Rounds. So the PWG recommendations were designed to promote innovation that is responsible and protects users and the economy, at the same time while addressing some of the risks that it can pose as stablecoins is used for payments. So agree with the principles and believe that a stablecoin would go far in preserving the global reserve currency. The dollar is the global reserve currency. I think there is no conflict there. I think it's actually important. We do, it is part of, in my view, the future of the payment system. It serves a purpose. It may not be the only payment mechanism or the only payment option, but it is could be an important part.
Thank you. And can the development of both a central bank digital currency and private stable coins coexist?
I see no reason why they could not coexist.
In looking at the report in its entirety, where do you believe that the regulatory framework should exist after reviewing it? Where should it exist within the federal government?
Mm-hmm. So the PWG report came down on the view that a consistent, less fragmented regulatory framework is preferable to one that is inconsistent, that less fragmentation will spur innovation more than a very fragmented system. When we reached out, when developing the report, we were hearing from firms, developers, that they would like more regulatory clarity. Currently, states do issue charters. They are learning a lot from this experience, but they do differ across states. State money transmitter licenses are across 49 different states. They vary quite a bit in terms of what they cover. They usually address consumer protection, but they are not designed for modern payment systems. So the PWG came out on the side of a less fragmented, more consistent, more comprehensive framework.
My time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Rounds. Senator Menendez, I believe, is now with us from New Jersey from his office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The defining feature of stable coins versus other types of cryptocurrencies is that they claim to be backed by reference assets such as the dollar or another currency. However, without proper transparency, this only provides the illusion of stability for stable coin investors. Madam Undersecretary, are market participants able to verify their portfolio holdings backing the stable coins they invest in?
Stablecoin issuers, perhaps under pressure from investors and regulators, are providing self-audited statements. Some of the major ones are providing self-audited statements on their holdings, but regulators are not in place to confirm those or to set the standards for them.
Well, I look at Tether, which is the world's largest stablecoin, which was created with the promise of a one-to-one backing with the dollar. And instead, reporting from Bloomberg found that many Tether stablecoins are backed by risky loans to Chinese real estate companies. So it seems to me that transparency is a cornerstone of our economy. Consumers and investors make the best decisions when they have the necessary information. And that's why I've always advocated for robust disclosure rules in different areas of the financial system. How does the Treasury intend to, do you propose to increase transparency to ensure market participants properly disclose the value of the assets backing stablecoins so that investors can have a true understanding of the risks associated with such assets?
Yes, the PWG report would is in favor of transparency of the assets. I think that's an important element in reducing run risk. I would mention, however, that transparency and disclosure are not sufficient to address run risk, that there still needs to be a certainty about the backing and the ability to actually deliver to an investor if they redeem their stablecoin. So it probably requires more than disclosure and transparency.
Okay, I'm for that. As stablecoins become more broadly used, both as a payment method and as an investment vehicle, Congress and the financial regulators need to address their more illicit uses, including money laundering, fraud, and sanctions evasion. As the working group noted in its report, criminals often use the most common and liquid forms of value. So stablecoins could be a particularly attractive vehicle for money laundering and terrorist financing. And that report also noted that effective international implementations of AML standards is critical. So the Financial Action Task Force published updated guidance on virtual currencies in October. What's your understanding of the level of effective implementation by our global partners? Who's doing well and who's not?
Yeah, the illicit finance issues are of serious concern to Treasury. Treasury has been leading the work in the Financial Action Task Force, as you mentioned. They issued a report. They are continuing to work on this. As I understand, implementation of standards is not even across jurisdictions. There is concerns about lack of implementation consistency in some, and they're working on those issues specifically. I think certainly my colleagues in FinCEN would be happy to follow up with you if you had additional questions.
Well, I'd like to. What are Treasury's priorities over the next 6 months with reference to increase that implementation?
So, as I mentioned, they are leading the Financial Action Task Force and focused specifically on implementation, especially exchanges that are operating in some foreign jurisdictions. I would mention the broader administration effort on digital assets is ongoing, and I understand there will be some more details announced in the next few weeks, so that can also provide some additional information, and again, we'd be happy to follow up with you on that.
Well, let me close by saying, you know, as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, I'm particularly concerned that countries like Venezuela, Russia, Iran will continue to use digital currencies to evade sanctions, which would weaken one of our most effective policy tools. in terms of foreign policy. The anonymity touted as a major benefit of stablecoins and other cryptocurrencies is inherently very useful for facilitating all kinds of illegal activity. And it's imperative that Treasury prioritize achieving concrete progress on this issue in the near term as the technology becomes a key part of the financial system. And we look forward to working with you on that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Menendez. Senator Hagerty of Tennessee is recognized.
Chairman Brown, thank you. Ranking Member Toomey, I appreciate your holding this hearing. Before I get to questions, I'd just like to reflect the fact that I also serve on the Foreign Relations Committee with Senator Menendez, and I share the concerns that he raised in terms of illicit activity, and I very much appreciate the ongoing work, and you're keeping us posted as to how you address that. At the same time that many of us are concerned about illicit activity, though, we see great promise in this industry, and some of the comments that you mentioned have raised some concerns with me. Your interchange with Senator Rounds, for example, talking about how the President's Working Group report has interpreted integrating states' rights and states' regulatory authorities in the grand scheme of things. I've approved of the innovation that occurs at a state level, and I'd be very interested in your view on how you would intend to incorporate state perspectives, or is this going to be a heavy-handed one-size-fits-all approach?
So I think the recommendations of the PWG report are building on the state frameworks that currently exist. The first recommendation that stablecoin issuers be an IDI, an insured depository institution, given the flexibility within that framework, is still that the IDI can be a state or federal charter.
Mm-hmm.
Second, it is building on the state money transmitter licenses. It is was not a recommendation to replace. I do think some of the state money transmitter licenses requirements probably need to be updated for digital assets, for example, and they were not designed for the kind of new emerging modern payment system. But it would the recommendation is that you be able to require some higher risk management standards, but not to replace the existing framework.
I appreciate your desire not to replace it. I hail from Tennessee. We have a wonderful state system there, and I think one that's agile and capable of incorporating recommendations, but at the same time solving in an agile way for new innovation. So I encourage that you continue to incorporate the state's perspective. I'd also like to touch on the another notion that you discussed with Senator Menendez regarding the risk of runs on a given stablecoin. And here, just on a theoretical level, would a fully reserved stablecoin pose a substantial risk of experiencing a run, or would that risk be higher or lower than, say, a fractional reserve bank, the risk of a run on a fractional reserve bank?
The fractional reserve bank is backed by either deposit insurance or lender of last resort discount window facilities that can, with regulation of the assets, and the fractional reserve can prevent runs. Fully reserved, for example, a money market fund, fully reserved 100% high quality assets, have limited reserve run, but for payments. So the difference between stablecoin and, say, a money market fund is that a money market fund, in my view, is purchased for the purpose of earning yield. You purchase a stablecoin to be able to use it as a payment mechanism. So they're slightly different. So I think the redemption features will distinguish, you know, a stablecoin from, say, a money market fund, a government money market fund.
I think as we look at this, we should be just particularly careful to accommodate the great potential that this shows, to recognize that we want to keep America a competitive market, that that's in the interest of our economic security. We also need to take our national security interest into account. But I hope that we do so in a way that it continues to make America a desired jurisdiction to do this rather than pushing this activity, which is very jurisdictionally movable. We'd rather do it here than push it to another market where we would have much less control and visibility on it.
So I would agree with your comment, and stablecoins that are stable, you know, tied to the U.S. dollar that are stable, I think are would be an important component of preserving a global reserve currency.
Yeah, I think that we should work together to make certain that our vital concerns, our vital national security concerns, are addressed as we try to make this market the leader. And I think we have every potential to do so. We have great innovators here, but I've had some very disturbing conversations with those in the industry about trying to decide which jurisdiction is going to be best. And I think that the work that you're undertaking to provide clarity, again, incorporating states' perspectives, we can do that. We can take the lead. But I also would underscore that time is of the essence here, because these markets are highly competitive.
Yes.
And a tremendous amount of capital is moving around the globe right now, trying to search for a reason there. I'd like to turn my ability for just a minute, my last question, regarding the FSOC's ability to address designating financial market utilities as systemically important under Title VIII of the Dodd-Frank Act. If you were to take this market and address the utilities here as systematically important, the stablecoin market is much smaller than many of the systemically important financial market utilities. How would you go about making this determination, and would this be the first time that such a designation has been made under Title VIII?
Yes. The short answer to your question about Title VIII for this would be yes, under the payment clearing settlement.
It would be the
but
first.
FSOC, yeah. The council has a responsibility to look for and identify risks to financial stability. It's been focused on digital assets more broadly and looking, for example, especially at whether the extent to which leverage may be raising the value of the prices of crypto assets. On stablecoin, I think it's a little early to prejudge how they could use their authorities. They certainly have a responsibility to think about how to use their authorities, but it is new and it would require it would depend on the facts and circumstances of the case.
Mm-hmm. We're running out of time, but I would just encourage you to keep in close contact with us because, again, I want to maintain a competitive market here rather than put such a heavy-handed regulatory perspective on this that we're going to shove this to another jurisdiction. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Warren from Massachusetts is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I start, I just want to echo the chairman in stressing the importance of voting on our Federal Reserve nominees this afternoon. This is our job, and we should not be playing games in order to delay this. So I hope we can get that vote done today. I want to talk about the cryptocurrencies here. You know, some cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin aren't backed by anything but hype. But stablecoins are different. They claim to be pegged to a fixed asset like the dollar. One stablecoin is supposedly backed up by $1 or a dollar equivalent. Even though boosters claim that stablecoins represent the future of the payment system, they aren't really being used to pay for real-world goods and services. Even so, stablecoins have taken off. Their market cap is now 35 times bigger than it was just 2 years ago. And instead of being used to pay for goods and services, those billions of dollars worth of stablecoins are used to lubricate speculation in the shadiest part of the crypto ecosystem, where people are lending, trading, and leveraging with no laws and no sheriff anywhere. The President's Working Group on Financial Markets recently identified a long list of risks posed by stablecoins: run risk, payment system risk, concentrated economic power, illicit finance, investor protection. Or to state that in slightly fancy, less fancy terms, it found that stablecoins run the risk of helping cheaters steal people's money, financing terrorism, cyber attack, ransoms, and the drug trade, causing a run on the financial system like we saw in 2008, and allowing big stablecoin users to dominate markets and harm consumers. Now, Secretary Lang, do you agree that these kinds of risks mean that stablecoins are not just an emerging threat to our financial system, but a threat that could become systemic if this market continues to grow rapidly?
So, Senator Warren, thank you for the question. So I do think there is some urgency to considering stablecoins and applying the appropriate regulations to reduce run risk and the potential for them to scale up quickly.
So are you – just let me remind you what my question is. Do they pose the threat of becoming a systemic risk?
Of becoming a systemic risk, yes.
Yes, they do. I agree that the stablecoin market poses significant risks and that Congress and our regulators need to contain these risks. And that is where you come in. You advise the Financial Stability Oversight Council, FSOC, and you sometimes sit in these meetings as Secretary Yellen's substitute. FSOC's job, according to Treasury's website, is, quote, identifying emerging threats to financial stability and coordinate regulatory actions to address them, end quote. So, Under Secretary Lang, if you believe that stablecoins are a serious emerging threat to our financial system, then have you advised FSOC to use the tools that Congress gave it specifically to mitigate threats before they get out of hand?
So FSOC, as you say, has the responsibility to identify risks to financial stability. It is discussing these issues. It does convene the regulators. They have been discussing consumer protection and investor protection, illicit finance, and taking steps to assess what risks and what authorities regulators have. The PWG was recommended, which is a subset of the FSOC with most tangible interests, to assess whether there are existing regulatory gaps, however, in assessing to address the risks of stablecoins as a use for payments, and identified some gaps and made some recommendations.
So you are moving at least in that direction? Is that what you're telling me? I want to make sure I just understand your testimony
yes,
here
PWG
today.
The PWG is making recommendations, and they complement the existing authorities that regulators have.
Well,
the SEC, the CFTC, and the banking regulators are issuing guidance carefully about how banks should.
Well, I understand about the other regulators. Mm-hmm. I'm asking about FSOC, mm-hmm. because I don't want monitoring to be a way to just avoid doing your job. In your testimony before the House Financial Services last week, you suggested that FSOC should not and would not act ahead of Congress. That's something the crypto industry might find comforting, but it is not consistent with FSOC's mission. Did you misstate something last week?
So I, what I intend to say, intended to say, I didn't see that, is FSOC has a responsibility to look at the tools it has.
Well,
it,
not just to look,
it,
but to
they
use.
They can apply. And the situation is developing very quickly. And so how different tools would apply, it's a bit difficult to prejudge how they would be used.
Okay, but you are willing to use them ahead of Congress?
If that is the case and it is assessed that they are a systemic risk that needs to be addressed.
Well, not that they are a systemic risk. Remember what it says on the website, before that risk has reached fruition. You know, I worry that you're approaching the crypto market with blinders on. You talk a lot about the benefits of stable coins, benefits that have been promised for years and that have still not materialized. And all the while, you are not talking about the risks that are flashing bright red in our faces here. Congress needs to put guardrails around crypto, and I'm writing a bill to do just that. But that there's no reason to delay. Pointing a finger at Congress does not give you or FSOC the right to ignore your current statutory responsibilities. Thank you. I apologize for running over, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lummis from Wyoming is recognized from her office.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Undersecretary Liang, thank you for appearing here today. I want to follow on the line of questioning that Senator Hagerty had begun a few minutes ago and ask about the recommendation in the President's Working Group report on stablecoin issuers that it should only be limited to insured depository institutions. With respect to the insurance requirement, is it the case that the FDIC and NCUA have found that stablecoins and their assets are insurable? And have these agencies committed to provide deposit insurance to newly chartered de novo institutions that issue a stablecoin?
So thank you for that question, Senator Lummis. The proposal for stablecoin issuers to be insured depository institutions, given the flexibility of that supervisory and regulatory regime, does not necessarily mean that stablecoins need deposit insurance. I think that would depend on the circumstances of the backing and the functionality of the stablecoin that is being provided. So the proposal is not, and the PWG did not recommend necessarily that stablecoins be backed by deposit insurance.
And what other types of backings would you believe adequately protects the consumer?
So I think the consumers can be protected with reserve assets that are truly high quality, that will provide some reduce the risk of runs by investors. There's also the protections provided by oversight of all the entities that go into providing supporting stablecoin as a payment. So the custodial wallets, the custody, the other ways of of liquidation of the redemption of the stablecoin that can be provided. So I think all those go into protecting consumers when they want to use stablecoin for payments.
So since there are alternative ways of bringing stablecoins inside the banking perimeter, like a 100% reserve bank with tailored holding company supervision, is that something you discussed and are willing to consider?
Yes, I think bringing stablecoins into an IDI framework that is adjusted for the risks of the stablecoin issuer, which would include solid backing of the stablecoin one for one, would certainly be an option.
Well, I'm so pleased to hear that that's your approach, because without it, I think the type of competition that Senator Hagerty wants to protect would be at risk if someone already has deposit insurance and can issue a stablecoin like, you know, J.P. Morgan's JPM coin. That would seem to limit competition in that marketplace to only the very, very largest banks in our country. And there may be other options that other institutions could explore. And it sounds like you are willing to discuss that with them. So I'm going to conclude with a different question. Does Treasury have a timeline for issuance of the guidance on the definition of broker for digital assets under the infrastructure bill? I know we were promised some public guidance on this a few months ago, and we have yet to see it.
I know Treasury is working very actively on that. The principle of the tax provisions is, you know, for those who owe taxes should pay their taxes. It is not designed to crimp the activities of crypto assets.
Well, I'm also very pleased to hear that, because some of the provisions in the definition, as you know, included people who wouldn't know the ultimate customer of a digital asset, the ultimate customer being the one who owes the taxes, as opposed to the inventor of the software or the hardware. So thanks very much. We look forward to that guidance coming out as soon as possible, and appreciate again your testimony today. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Thank you, Senator Lummis. Senator Van Hollen of Maryland is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Toomey, and
I know there's some discussion about moving forward on the vote on the Fed nominations today. I hope we'll move forward on all five this afternoon. Ms. Liang, I've been monitoring some of the testimony. Welcome. And we do want to encourage innovation. I support that, but we also want to make sure that we protect consumers. You would agree?
Absolutely.
And I do want to focus on some of the things that could happen when things go wrong, where there are protections under our existing financial arrangements that do not apply to stable coins, even though stable coins are intended to be tied to a stable base. As you know, when it comes to the deposits in banks, we have the Federal Deposit Insurance Act that makes sure that consumers are protected up to some amount of their deposits, right? Is there any protection if the stable coin issuer was to go belly up for consumers?
There currently, the protection would be provided by the quality of the assets that are held in reserve against the stable coin, but there is not deposit insurance, but it would be...
But are they, let me ask you
but
this.
But they are not regulated.
Are there any standards with respect to what
standards.
The reserves have to be?
No, there are no standards at this point.
Right. So currently, if the issuer were to go belly up, in other words, if they were to go out of business and they didn't have reserves to cover the deposits, the depositors, the holders of stablecoin would just be out of luck, right?
That's correct.
That's right. Okay. There are also protections that apply to consumers when it comes to transactions in things like credit cards or debit cards, right?
Yes.
And for example, if there are payment errors, fraud, or unauthorized transactions, then consumers have existing protections when they're dealing with credit cards or debit cards, right?
Correct.
And when it comes to stable coins, if there's some error, if there's some kind of fraud or unauthorized transaction or a hacking, are there any protections for the consumers of stable coins?
So stable coins are licensed under state money transmitter regimes, and some, there are consumer protection laws in those. They vary by state. They may apply to stable coins in some states. They may not.
So right now it's hit or miss, depending on whether you're in a state that provides some protection and the extent of that protection. Is that right?
As I understand it, yes.
Right. So just to pick up on the question from Senator Warren, in terms of the work group, the presidential work group that was put together, clearly you identified some of the risks that we're talking about right now. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And do you believe that the executive branch currently has the authority to move forward to protect consumers, for example, in the two areas I mentioned, right, with respect to some kind of stable coin equivalent of depository insurance or national rules that protect consumers from errors or fraud? Do you believe that the administration, the executive branch, has the authority to regulate in that area, or is that an area that would require legislation?
I believe that is an area that would require legislation, that the risk of runs and the risk of payment system disruptions, including protections to consumers, is a gap in the current regulatory system.
And in response to Senator Warren, you indicated that there may be some areas where FSOC could move. What, if not these areas, can you describe some of the areas mm-hmm. where you think you may have the authority to move at the executive branch level?
I think each agency will take actions consistent with their mandates, but it is not sufficient for the gap, for the risks of runs and payment system. FSOC has some tools, but it is not a substitute. It would not provide a consistent, comprehensive framework. It could address particular risks as they arose, depending on the facts and circumstances. But it's not a comprehensive, consistent framework that legislation could provide.
And I hope you'll work with those of us on this committee who are interested in providing that kind of consumer protection regime and standards in this area.
Absolutely. We would be very happy to work on it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Chairman Howland. Senator Daines from Montana is recognized.
Chairman Brown, thank you. As I said in our previous hearing on stablecoins, about 2 months ago, I do believe the stablecoin policy is an area where there should be, there can be, hopefully there will be, some broad bipartisan agreement and compromise. I do believe that we should pursue a light-touch approach to regulation. But I also believe a bipartisan legislative framework on stablecoins is possible and I do believe necessary. Bipartisan legislation will also help provide users as well as market participants with the certainty they need to let innovation flourish without fear that regulators will overreach using authority in existing statutes that in no way contemplated the emergence of stablecoins. I would urge my colleagues to avoid any partisan solution and instead seek consensus on truly something that's bipartisan. There's a moment here that we need to seize that would provide certainty needed for private industry to grow as well as to prosper. I think this will help provide the best pathway for this technology to grow in a way that benefits the folks back home in Montana, all Americans, and the global financial system. Furthering the use of stable coins will help to increase the speed of payments and lower costs in the financial system, and I believe these are results we should all agree are worth pursuing. Turn to my questions. Undersecretary Lang, on absent legislation from Congress, can you provide us a sense as to which federal agencies would be most likely to issue regulations relating to stablecoins and on which statutes they would derive their authority?
So, Senator Daines, thank you for the question. I would need to defer to the individual agencies as to how they would interpret their authorities and their strategies. I would say currently the SEC and CFTC are approaching crypto assets more broadly to prevent fraud, to prevent manipulation, to protect investors and consumers. The banking agencies are taking actions to issuing guidance to advise banks about their activities in crypto. But currently, I don't think there is the authority for any agency to address the risks of stablecoins, to prevent runs, and to prevent disruptions in the payment system should stablecoins be used widely as payments.
I think, you know, hearing you answer that question, it leads me to a follow-up in terms of your thoughts around the need for adopting a clear regulatory framework that would be established through bipartisan legislation. Might that be a catalyst for a more widespread adoption of digital assets?
I think a consistent, comprehensive framework could be a catalyst for innovation as well. I think developers need clarity on how they can operate, how they can develop their business that will be viewed as permissible in the marketplace, to serve customers, to protect customers, as well as to provide a product that they think can deliver faster payments, cheaper payments. So I do think more regulatory clarity can actually, promote innovation.
And I think the why we need bipartisanship here, and in my opinion, a lighter touch, is that we have an opportunity where we could actually put the right kind of framework in place that could accelerate innovation. Mm-hmm. The wrong framework, and in my opinion, a too much of a heavy hand, could certainly stifle innovation. So this is the moment we could actually accelerate it, I believe, with the right regulatory framework.
Yes, I agree. And we are seeing stablecoin issuers pursuing bank-like charters and talking to the banking regulators. So they do believe that this is an area, this is a path, possible path forward.
And I think any time we look at a situation like this, an issue like this, I always come back to the question of global competitiveness, what this means certainly around the world. If the U.S. does not clearly define this landscape, would it be unreasonable to expect a large portion of this activity to perhaps migrate overseas to countries with more favorable and clear regulatory structures?
I think businesses would tend to migrate to where regulations are more clear. I would absolutely agree with that. There is an incentive to want to tie to the value of the dollar because the dollar is the global reserve currency. And so I think there's a pull from the strong dollar and all that stands behind a strong U.S. dollar. Technology can help that, but the dollar itself is the value, the global status of the dollar is supported by the rule of law and the governance of the country and the economic potential. But the technology will want to, is incentivized to move to be backed by the dollar because of that. And it will help it, I think, if we can provide a good framework.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Daines. Senator Cortez Masto from Nevada is recognized from her office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Undersecretary, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. Let me just say, I agree with Senator Daines that this issue really is bipartisan. It should be always when it comes to the needs system. And in that spirit, that's why I look forward to voting for the 5 Federal Reserve nominees this afternoon. We need a full Federal Reserve Board to bring down prices and promote full employment and wage gains, and we really should politics with that. Let me say, Mr. Chairman, thank you for this hearing. It's such an important issue. I also appreciate the ranking member putting laying out his principles to talk about developing a legislative framework for stable coins. It's such an important area, and I think it's an area we need to focus on. So, Undersecretary, let me start with a couple of questions, and I'm going to follow up on Senator Dane's questions to you about which agencies are responsible for the oversight right now of stable coins. Are there any federal agencies that are responsible right now to ensure that stablecoin issuers are adequately backed?
Currently, stablecoin issuers are backed by either state money are regulated by state money transmitter licenses or state charters.
So right now, there's no federal agency looking at whether they're adequately backed. It's state agencies. That's if the states have some sort of regime for that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
And then, it goes back to what Senator Van Hollen had said. Some states have it, some don't. So there is some patchwork there. Let me ask you this. With respect to stablecoin and cryptocurrency, do they always have to register as a money services business under FinCEN's federal regime?
Yes.
Yeah. And thank you, because, I last Congress I worked on the FinCEN Improvement Act, led that bill, and it was important that we gave FinCEN the authority over cryptocurrencies and other technological financial payments for this very reason. Do you feel that FinCEN has a robust framework to prevent and sanction illicit finance when it comes to stable coins or any cryptocurrency?
Yes. Yes, FinCEN. So registering as a money service business under the state transmitter license triggers a number of FinCEN regulations, AML, BSA, AML, CFT regulations. They've been working on this for many years. Some of the initial guidance on what was called virtual assets came out in 2014. They lead some of the international work. This is an area of strong focus. They understand and want to enforce stronger, may have stronger implementation and enforcement. As I understand it, some of the issues are related to activities abroad, exchanges abroad, and with the Financial Action Task Force, they are working globally to try to improve implementation. This is an area also for the administration more broadly, which they are working on and will be announcing more work on in the coming weeks.
Great, thank you for that. So let me go back to the report that the working group put out. Some of the prudential concerns, one of the areas that you've talked about is to address additional concerns about systemic risk and concentration of economic power. And then in there, it states supervisors should have authority to implement standards to promote interoperability among stablecoins. Can you discuss the interoperability piece of it and elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah. So one of the three prudential risks is this possibility of increased concentration of economic power. This has to do with the network externalities of a payment system where everyone, there are greater benefits if everyone is part of the same payment system. So if you have large firms, the ability to scale up a payment system could potentially increase market power. One way to diminish or to offset some of that unwanted increase in market power would be to promote interoperability among stablecoin issuers. And that just allows for consumers to exchange one stablecoin for another, so to speak, and allow them to interact with each other so you don't create a number of different sort of closed-loop systems.
And I know my time is up, but I would imagine that there's going to be issues with respect to the standardization of that interoperability that we would have to address.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a complicated issue of which more discussion would definitely need to be taken.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Cortez Masto. Senator Ossoff is recognized from his office from Georgia. Senator Sinema from Arizona is recognized from her office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to our witnesses for being here today. As you know, Mr. Chairman, I co-chaired the Senate's Financial Innovation Caucus alongside my friend, Senator Lummis of Wyoming. So I'm very glad that we're holding this hearing today. As we discuss new financial technologies, I want to ensure that we balance common sense protections for everyday Arizonans while creating an environment where innovation can thrive. Undersecretary Liang, it's great to speak with you today and to discuss this important topic. The President's Working Group report on stablecoins calls for Congress to pass a solution to avoid runs on stablecoins and to ensure users have common sense protections to safeguard stablecoin stated value. These objectives align with some of the concerns I raised in our last stablecoin hearing. Yeah, there's general agreement that this is a noble goal, but it's important to be thoughtful about the solution that we propose. I'm interested in ensuring there are adequate consumer protections to give Arizona consumers confidence in the value of stablecoins, but I also want to make sure regulatory requirements are not overly onerous. We don't want to discourage innovation or limit consumer choice. Can you elaborate on how the report balances these competing priorities?
So thank you for that question. So I think that was the underlying principles of the report, to balance innovation, competition for payment systems, and while at the same time protecting consumers. So our view is that a more clear, consistent, comprehensive regulatory framework goes a long way to promoting innovation and providing choices for consumers. It does require that stable coins actually be stable, and so there were some recommendations about how to achieve stability in a stable coin. It requires that stable coins be able to provide the payment services that it offers in a reliable way, and we want the payment system to be resilient. So it makes a number of recommendations in that space.
Well, thank you, Undersecretary Liang. I'm encouraged to see this discussion of decentralized finance and Web3 evolve. I think it has the potential to make everyday transactions faster, safer, simpler, and more affordable for everyday Arizonans. With any new groundbreaking technology, the internet in particular comes to mind, the technology itself is quite promising, though many of the early use cases ultimately don't work and don't make it. The technology, however, endures, and the next group of entrepreneurs improve on or disrupt what came before them. So that's the nature of innovation, and I'm committed to ensuring we have an innovation ecosystem that's a win-win for Arizona entrepreneurs and consumers alike. I see decentralized finance and Web3 in this way. Our job is to think through what works and what doesn't, what helps consumers and what doesn't, and to create common sense rules of the road that provide certainty for everyone. It's important to me that we address some of the short-term challenges with these technologies while also not losing sight of the long game when it comes to the potential benefits of decentralized finance and Web3. Are you and the administration aligned in that thinking on this issue?
So I agree that DeFi is growing rapidly. There are many different range of products and services being offered, and the potential for benefits are there. Innovation is, responsible innovation is absolutely supported with the, alongside of making sure that investors and consumers are protected through actions by the market regulators, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or the state regulators where appropriate. So agree with your assessment.
Thank you. Finally, I received a letter from Assistant Secretary Davidson in response to a bipartisan letter I sent in December with Senators Portman, Warner, Crapo, Toomey, and Lummis. Our letter requested that the cryptocurrency provision included in our Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act is implemented in accordance with congressional intent. I'm not encouraged by aspects of the letter we received, including but not limited to an acknowledgement that congressional intent is that cryptocurrency miners, stakers, and those solely engaged in the business of selling hardware or software to allow individuals to control private keys, they should not be considered brokers for the purpose of this section. Providing certainty to these groups and ensuring that a future rulemaking aligns with congressional intent is a priority for me, and I believe it's possible to help close the tax gap while also ensuring that the rules are clear and fair so that innovators are not inadvertently or unintentionally subjected to these requirements. So my question for you is, we admit that the department will work closely with me and the other authors of the letter to consider development of a notice of proposed rulemaking to ensure that the law is executed as Congress intended.
I believe the Treasury Department's principle is to not to squash crypto assets, but to collect taxes from those who owe taxes.
So just to clarify, and I know my time has expired, Mr. Chairman, Undersecretary, would you be willing to work with the authors of our bipartisan letter to ensure that congressional intent is honored?
Yeah, I'm sure Treasury and my colleagues in the Office of Tax Policy would be very happy to work with you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Sinema. Senator Ossoff from Georgia is recognized from his office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Lang, for joining us and for your service and for the report that the President's Working Group has submitted. Could you please restate briefly what are the principal risks that you assess to be posed by the growth of the stablecoin market?
So briefly, stablecoins have been growing and their potential to be used for payments in the ordinary world, the non-crypto world, has been increasing. So the risks that we included and identified in the PWG report are, one, the risk that investors could run on a stablecoin, perhaps because investors lose confidence in the value of the assets that are behind it. Two, the risks of disruptions to the payment system if the operations are not held to standards that ensure that payments can be made as promised. And then third, the increased risk from higher market concentration if some stablecoins were to scale up very quickly and increase market share. So those are the three risks that were identified in the PWG report for which the PWG believed current regulations do not address.
Thank you, Ms. Lang. And the report states that stablecoins, depending on context, could be considered derivatives, or commodities or securities. Why are existing regulatory authorities, in your opinion, insufficient?
So currently, stablecoins could be, you know, I leave it to my colleagues at SEC and CFTC as to whether stablecoins are securities or commodities. But as a payments mechanism to be used by households and businesses to facilitate payment transactions, that I think is a separate consideration, and that is what the PWG report focused on.
And what regulatory actions might you recommend be undertaken for which the department currently lacks statutory authority?
So currently, stablecoin issuers are authorized. They're licensed by state money transmitter laws, some trust banks in some states. There is not a federal agency. The principal recommendation is that stablecoin issuers register, be required to be insured depository institutions, where the regulation and supervision of these institutions would be matched to the risks and activities of a stablecoin issuer, so that if it does not make loans or extend credit, it's not subject to the same set of rules that other traditional commercial banks might be.
And what are the most common mechanisms by which issuers peg the value of the stablecoin to the U.S. dollar, and which of those mechanisms, in your view, present the most risk or may most require some form of prudential regulation at the federal level?
There are many different stablecoins issuers right now. I think the predominant is tied to the value of the U.S. dollar, and they do that by holding reserve assets in U.S. dollars that are on redemption request would be able to be converted to a dollar, to $1. So that is the primary, by far the largest stablecoin issuers. The issue at question is whether the issuer, the stablecoin issuer, could actually provide a user a dollar on request. And the IDI framework, the Insured Depository Institution framework, would be an important step to ensuring that stablecoins, in fact, deliver the dollar when asked.
And in your view and in the analysis of the working group and of relevant law, Ms. Lang, you don't believe that currently regulatory authorities have adequate statutory authority to, for example, impose reserve requirements or other prudential requirements on such issuers to ensure that they can maintain the peg if there's a sudden increase in demand for redemption?
I don't think there is any regulation that requires them to do that, no.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Lang. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Ossoff. Thank you, Madam Undersecretary, for joining us today. Senators who wish to submit questions for the record, those questions are due 1 week from today, Tuesday, February 22nd. Witnesses, you, Madam Undersecretary, have 45 days to respond to any of those questions. Thank you again. The committee is adjourned.